Chapter 44. A county bond issue in 1977 had paid for a handsome renovation to our hospital. At one end of the main floor, there was a modern, though quite dark, chapel where I'd once sat with Margaret and her family as her mother passed away. It was there that I found the Ruffins, all 8 children, all 21 grandchildren, and every spouse but Leon's wife. Reverend Thurston Small was there, along with a sizable contingent from the church. Esau was upstairs in the intensive care unit, waiting outside Miss Callie's room. Sam told me that she had awakened from a nap with a sharp pain in her left arm, then numbness in her leg, and before long she was mumbling incoherently. An ambulance rushed her to the hospital. The doctor was certain it was initially a stroke, one that precipitated a mild heart attack. She was being heavily medicated and monitored. The last report from the doctor had been around 8 p.m. Her condition was described as serious but stable. Visitors were not allowed, so there was little to do but wait and pray and greet friends as they came and went. After an hour in the chapel, I was ready for bed. Max, third in the birth order but the undeniable leader, organized a schedule for the night. At least 2 of Miss Callie's children would be somewhere in the hospital at all times. We checked with the doctor again around 11, and he sounded reasonably optimistic that she was still stable. She was asleep, as he put it, but upon further questioning, admitted that they had knocked her out to prevent another stroke. "Go home and rest," he said. "Tomorrow could be a long day." We left Mario and Gloria in the chapel and moved en masse to the Hocut House, where we ate ice cream on a side porch. Sam had taken Esau home to Lowtown. I was delighted that the rest of the family preferred staying at my place. Of the 13 adults there, only Leon and Carlotta's husband, Sterling, would touch alcohol. I opened a bottle of wine, and the 3 of us passed on the ice cream. Everyone was exhausted, especially the children. The day had begun with an adventure to the courthouse for a peek at the man who had been terrorizing our community. That seemed like a week ago. Around midnight, Al gathered the family together in my den for one last word of prayer. A chain prayer, as he called it, in which every adult and child gave thanks for something and asked for God's protection of Miss Callie. Sitting there on my sofa, fervently holding hands with Bonnie and with Mario's wife, I felt the presence of the Lord. I knew my beloved friend, their mother and grandmother, would be fine. 2 hours later, I was lying in bed wide awake, still hearing the sharp crack of the rifle in the courtroom, the thud of the bullet as it hit Danny, the panic that followed. I rewound and replayed every word of Dr. Vero's and wondered in what manner of hell poor Hank Hooten had been living for the past few years. Why had he been set loose on society again? And I worried about Miss Callie, though her condition seemed to be under control and she was in good hands. I eventually slept for 2 hours, then eased downstairs where I found Mario and Leon drinking coffee at the kitchen table. Mario had left the hospital an hour earlier. There'd been no change. They were already plotting the stringent weight reduction plan the family would impose on Miss Callie when she was back home. And she would begin an exercise program that would include long walks each day around Lowtown, regular checkups, vitamins, lean foods. They were serious about this new health regimen, though everyone knew that Miss Callie would do exactly as she wished. A few hours later, I began the chore of boxing up the things and junk I'd collected in 9 years and cleaning out my office. The new editor was a pleasant lady from Meridian, Mississippi, and she wanted to get started by the weekend. Margaret offered to help, but I wanted to go slowly and reminisce as I emptied drawers and files. It was a personal moment, and I preferred to be alone. Mr. Caudle's books were finally removed from the dusty shelves where they had been placed long before I arrived. I planned to store them somewhere at home in case a descendant of his showed up and asked questions. My emotions were mixed. Everything I touched brought back a story, a deadline, a trip deep into the county to chase a lead, interview a witness, or meet someone I hoped would be interesting enough for a profile. And the sooner I finished the packing, the closer I would be to walking out of the building and catching an airplane. Bobby Ruffin called at 9:30. Miss Callie was awake, sitting up, sipping some tea, and they were allowing visitors for a few minutes. I hurried to the hospital. Sam met me in the hall and led me through the maze of rooms and cubicles in ICU. "Don't talk about anything that happened yesterday, okay?" he said as we walked.
"Sure."
"Nothing exciting. They won't even allow the grandkids in, afraid that would make her heart rate go crazy. Everything is real quiet."
She was awake, but barely. I had expected to see the bright eyes and brilliant smile, but Miss Callie was barely conscious. She recognized me. We hugged. I patted her right hand. The left one had an IV. Sam, Esau, and Gloria were in the room. I wanted a few minutes alone so I could finally tell her I was selling the paper, but she was in no condition for such news. She had been awake for almost 2 hours, and she obviously needed more sleep. Perhaps in a day or so we could have a lively chat about it. After 15 minutes, the doctor showed up and asked us to leave. We left, we came back, and the vigil continued throughout the 4th of July, though we were not allowed inside the ICU again.